translation himself, but he saw no use in it, and he felt suddenly downcast. In any case, once the power and light system had started to go to pieces, the rate of decline would undoubtedly be progressively faster. Back in the living room, he could scarcely doubt now that the light had faded still more. Deep shadows seemed to have moved out from behind the chairs in the corners of the room. The lights are going out. The lights of the world, he thought. And he felt like a child going alone into the dark. Princess lay dozing on the floor. The fading of the lights could mean nothing to her, but she sensed his nervousness and came up restlessly sniffing, whining a little. He stood on the porch again. Minute by minute, the long chains of streetlights grew less and less luminous, more and more yellow. The high wind, he thought, must be helping, blowing down a power line here, weakening a switch connection there. The fire, too, was sweeping across the forested ridges, unchecked by men, burning power lines, perhaps even power houses. After a while, the light seemed to fade no further, but to remain at a constant dimness. He went in again, and pulling another bridge lamp to the side of his chair, he was able to read comfortably with two lights instead of one. Princess lay down again to doze. By now it was late, but he did not want to go to sleep. He felt as if he were sitting up by the deathbed of his most treasured and oldest friend. He remembered those great words, "Let there be light," and there was light. This seemed the other end of that story. After a while, he went to look at the clock again and saw that it had stopped with the hands symmetrically upward at 11:05. His watch showed him that by now it was well after midnight. The lights might still continue many hours, or even might burn dimly for days. Yet he did not want to go to bed. He tried to read again, but finally slipped off to sleep in the easy chair where he was sitting. With power and light, it was all so carefully contrived that even in the disaster, there was no need for adjustment. The men fell sick, but the generator still sent out along the wires their finely timed pulsations. So, when the brief agony of mankind was ended, the light still burned. So it continued through the weeks. If a wire broke and cut out a whole town from the flow of power, the system adjusted before that wire had had time to fall to the ground. If a powerhouse failed, just as quickly the other powerhouses in the system, stretching across hundreds of miles, took up the slack and sent out more power to fulfill the need. Yet, in any system, as in a chain or a road, there is always a weakest link. That is the fatal flaw of all systems. The water would continue to flow. The great generators could spin upon their oil-bathed bearings for years. But the flaw lay in the governors which controlled the generators. No one had ever bothered to make them wholly automatic. Once every 10 days they were inspected for oil. Once a month, perhaps, there was need to add oil to them. After 2 months without care, the oil supplies grew low, and one by one, as the weeks passed, the governors began to go out of action. When one failed, automatically, the great water nozzle changed angle and the water flowed through without touching the wheel. Then the generator ceased revolving and sent out no more power. As generator after generator was thus cut out of the system, the strain upon the few remaining ones became greater and greater, and the decline of the system became cumulative. When he awoke, he noticed that the lights had faded still more. The filaments in the electric lamps were only an orange-red now. He could look at them without hurting his eyes. Now, although he had not turned off any of the lamps, the room was in half darkness. The lights are going out. The lights are going out! How often, in how many centuries, had those words been said? Sometimes in matter-of-fact tones, sometimes in panic. Now literally, now as symbol. How much light had meant in all the story of man? Light of the world, light of life, light of knowledge. A deep shiver shook him, but he stilled his panic. After all, he thought, the great system of power and light had held up for an amazingly long time, all its automatic processes functioning, though the men were gone. He thought clear back to that first day when he had come down out of the mountains, not yet even knowing what had happened. Then he had passed the powerhouse and felt the reassurance that everything must be normal because he saw the water pouring out from the tail races and heard the dim, continuous hum of the generators. He felt again a curious touch of local pride in thinking of it. Perhaps no system had lasted so long. These might well be the last electric lights to be left burning in the world, and when they faded, the lights would be out for a long, long time. No longer sleepy, he sat there, feeling that he should not go to sleep, wishing at least that the end would come quickly and with dignity and not be dragged out too long. Again he felt the light fading, and he thought, this is the end. But still it lingered, the filaments now only a cherry red. And then again they faded. As a sled on a hillside, slowly first, then gaining momentum, just for a moment he thought or imagined they flared more brightly. And then they were gone. Princess stirred in her sleep, then suddenly barked the half-bark of a dream. Was it a death knell? He went outside. Perhaps, he thought, that was just the failure of some local line. But he was really sure that it had not been. He peered through the darkness, all the thicker for the smoke that was heavy in the air, changing the moon into an orange ball. He could see no light, not along the streets, nor anywhere on the bridge. This, then, was the end. Let there be no light! And there was no light. No use being melodramatic, he thought. Going inside, he stumbled around until he had found the drawer where his mother kept candles. Putting one into a candlestick, he sat again by its feeble but steady and continuing light. Nevertheless, he continued to feel a little shaken. Chapter 6. The fading out of the lights had a strangely severe effect upon Ish. Even in the full daylight, he seemed to feel those shadows creeping in from the edges toward him. The dark ages were closing in. He found himself hoarding matches and flashlights and candles, piling them up in spite of himself as a psychological protection. Yet actually, in a little while, he discovered that the absence of electric light was not really as important to him as the absence of electric power, particularly of refrigeration. The icebox was dead now, and his food spoiled. In the deep freeze units, the fresh meat and butter and heads of lettuce soon relapsed into mere smelling masses of corruption. Now came the change of the season. He was completely lost as to the passage of the weeks and months, but with the geographer's eye, he could still tell something about the time of year from the look of things. Now, he guessed, it must be October. And the first rain came to confirm him. From the way it settled down, it seemed likely to last longer than one expected of the first storm. He stayed at home, managing to amuse himself fairly well. He played his accordion. He browsed through several books. Ones he had always meant to read, and now he was undoubtedly going to have time to do so. Now and then he looked out at the fine drifting rain and the clouds low over the tops of the houses. The next day, he went out to see what was happening. Still thinking of the drama, he was prepared to watch. Not so much had occurred, it seemed, at first. But after a while, he began to notice things. On San Lupo Drive, a drain pipe had plugged with the washing in of all the unswept leaves that lay in the gutter. After the drain pipe had plugged, the water had swirled across the street to the downhill side and flooded over the curb. The stream of water had worked its way across the tangle of tall grass which had been the Hart's lawn and seeped under the door. Their floors and rugs must be soaked and slimy with mud. Below the house, the water had broken out and run through the rose garden, leaving a small gully behind it, at last disappearing into the drainage of a storm sewer on the street below. It was just a little matter, and yet it showed what must be happening all over the country. Men had built roads and drains and walls and thousands of other obstructions to the natural flow of water. These could survive and function only because men were constantly at hand to repair and clean the thousands of little breaks and blockages which showed up at every change of the weather. Ish himself could have cleaned out that clogged drain in 2 minutes by merely scraping the leaves back from the grating where they had plugged it. But he saw no point to stretching out his hand. There were thousands, millions of spots where the same thing must be happening. The roads and the drains and the walls had been constructed only for man's convenience. And now that man was gone, there was no need of them. The water might just as well follow its natural courses and cut back through the rose garden. Soaked and muddy, the Hartz' rugs would begin to rot where they lay. No matter. To think of that as something bad was merely to think in terms of what had once been and no longer existed. As he walked back home, he suddenly came upon a large black billy goat, calmly eating the hedge, which Mr. Osmer used to clip so carefully. Ish looked at the billy goat in amusement, and in some curiosity, wondering where he could have come from. No one kept goats anywhere near such a respectable street as San Lupo. The goat desisted from eating the hedge and looked at Ish. Perhaps, thought Ish, the animal was looking also at the man in amusement and some curiosity. Men now had rarity value. Having looked for a few seconds, as if it might be equal to equal, the goat again returned to the more profitable business of eating the long shoots which had grown out from the hedge. Doubtless, they were very succulent. Princess suddenly returned from some expedition of her own and flew at the strange animal in a frenzy of barking. The goat put down his horns and made a sudden dash at the dog. Princess, who seldom had much stomach for a fight, turned quickly with her rabbit-like dodge and raced back to her man. The goat resumed eating. A few minutes later, Ish saw the goat walking calmly along the sidewalk, as if he owned it and all of San Lupo Drive. Well, why not? Thought Ish. Perhaps he does. This is certainly a new deal. During this time, when the rain kept him mostly indoors, his thoughts turned a little toward religion, as they had when he walked through the cathedral. This time he found a large, annotated Bible on his father's bookshelves and tried browsing here and there in it. The Gospels seemed strangely unsatisfying, probably because they dealt mostly with the problems of a man involved in the social group. Render unto Caesar was a strangely unprofitable text when there was no more Caesar and not even a collector of internal revenue. Sell whatever thou hast and give to the poor, as ye would that men should do unto you. Love thy neighbor as thyself. All these presupposed a functioning society of many people. As the world now was, a Pharisee or a Sadducee might perhaps still follow the set rites of formalized religion. But the very humanity of the teachings of Jesus rendered them obsolete. Turning back to the Old Testament, he began Ecclesiastes and found himself suddenly more at home. The old fellow, the preacher, Koheleth, as the notes called him, whoever he might have been, had a curious way of striking the naturalistic note, of sensing the problem of the individual against the universe. Sometimes it was almost as if he had imagined what Ish was now experiencing. And if the tree fall toward the south or toward the north, in the place where the tree falleth, there it shall be. Ish thought of that tree in Oklahoma, which had fallen to block Highway 66. And again he read, "Two are better than one, for if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow, but woe unto him that is alone when he falleth." And Ish thought of the great fear that had been upon him when he was left alone, and he had felt all too vividly that there would be none to help him up if he fell. He read through, marveling at the clear-eyed naturalistic acceptance of the universe. There was even a line, "Surely the serpent will bite without enchantment." He came to the end of the last chapter, and his eyes fell to the lines which began on the lower part of the page, "The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's." He read, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for thy love is better than wine." Ish stirred uneasily. In all these long months, he had rarely had such feelings. Now again he realized that, more than he thought from day to day, the shock of the whole catastrophe had affected him. It was all like some old story of enchantment in which a king sat and watched life pass by, unable to mingle with it. Other men had done differently. Even those who had drunk themselves to death had, in a sense, been partaking of life. But he himself, in observing what happened, had merely been rejecting life. What made life anyway? Many people had asked that question. Even Koheleth, the preacher, was far from the first. And each had come up with a different answer, except those who admitted that no answer could be found. Here was he, Isherwood Williams, a strange mingling of realities and fantasies and pressures and reactions. And there, all outside, was the vast empty city with misty rain falling upon the long empty streets and the twilight now beginning to deepen. Between the two, him and everything outside him, there lay some kind of strange bond. As one changed, so the other changed also. It was as if there were a vast equation with many terms on each side and yet only two great unknowns. He was on one side, X perhaps you would call him, and on the other side was Y, everything which was called the world. And two sides of the equation always were trying to keep more or less in balance and never quite managed it. Perhaps the real balance only came with death. Perhaps that was what Koheleth, in his fine, disillusioned mind, was thinking when he wrote, "The living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything." But this side of death, the two halves of the equation tried always to be in balance. If the X side changed and he, Ish, felt within him the pressure of some gland, or if he suffered shock, or if there was even something so simple as that he grew bored, then he did something, and that changed the other side of the equation, if only a little. And then there was again a temporary balance. But if, on the other hand, the world outside changed, if there was a catastrophe wiping out the human race, or if merely it should stop raining, then the X side, being Ish, would also have to change, and that would mean more action. And then there would be again a temporary balance. And who could say whether in the long run, one side or the other side of the equation began more of the actions? Then, before he really thought what he was doing, he had risen to his feet, and on second thought he knew that he had done so because again a feeling of desire had stirred within him. The equation had got out of balance, and he had risen restlessly to set it right again. And already he was affecting the world because Princess had leaped up at his rising and was wandering about the room. Yet at the same time he heard the rain beat a little harder against the window. Then he looked up at it to see what was happening. And so the world had also pressed in upon him and caused him to do something. And after that, he set out to get himself some supper. The almost complete removal of man, though in some ways an unprecedented earthly catastrophe, had not in the slightest affected the Earth's relation to the sun, or the sizes and locations of the oceans and continents, or any other factor influencing the weather. Therefore, the first autumn storm which swept down from the Aleutians upon the coast of California was ordinary and conventional. Its moisture extinguished the forest fires. Its raindrops washed from the atmosphere the particles of smoke and dust. Behind it, a brisk wind swept down cool and crystal clear air from the northwest. The temperature dropped sharply. Ish stirred in his sleep and gradually came to consciousness. He was cold. The other side has changed, he thought, and pulled up another blanket. He grew warm. Oh, Prince's daughter, he thought dreamily. Thy breasts are like two. And he drifted to sleep. In the morning, the house was chilly. He wore a sweater as he got himself his breakfast. He considered building a fire in the fireplace, but the cooler weather had also made him feel more active, and so he thought that he would not stay indoors much that day. After breakfast, he stood on the front porch to drink in the view. As always, after one of these storms, the air was clear. The wind had died down. The red towers of the Golden Gate Bridge, miles away, stood against the blue sky, as if close enough to touch. He turned a little toward the north to look at the peak of Tamalpais, and suddenly started. Between him and the mountain, on this side of the bay, a thin column of smoke rose straight up through the calm air, a slight wisp, the kind of smoke column that should come from a small fire. Particularly from one burning in a fireplace and ascending through a chimney. It might, he realized, have been rising there 100 times before when he had looked out, but in the smoky and misty atmosphere, he would not have noticed it. Now, it was like a signpost. Of course, it might be a fire burning from some natural cause, without any human being in its vicinity. He had investigated many smokes like that with no results. But that was not so likely now, because the rain would have smothered such fires. In any case, it could not be more than a couple of miles off, and his first thought was to jump into the station wagon and investigate. That would cause no more harm than the loss of a few minutes, for which he had no particular use anyway. But something stopped him. His attempts to establish human contact had not been rewarding. That old shyness rose up within him, as it had sometimes in the old days, when the thought of attending a dance would put him into a sweat. He began to temporize, just as he used to do when he said that he had a great deal of work to do, and so buried himself in a book instead of going to the dance. Did Crusoe really want to be rescued from his desert island, where he was lord of all that he surveyed? That was a question that people had asked. But even if Crusoe had been the kind of man who wanted to escape, to renew contacts with other people, that would not mean that he himself, Ish, was such a person. Perhaps he would cherish his island. Basically, perhaps, he feared human entanglements. Almost in panic, as if fleeing from a temptress, he called Princess, got into the car, and drove off in the opposite direction. He spent most of the day wandering restlessly through the hills. At times he observed what the rain had done to the roads. By now, there was no longer that hard and fast line between road and what was not road. Leaves had dropped from the cold of the autumn and the high winds. Little dead branches had blown off and fallen on the pavement. Here and there, a washing stream of water had left a delta-like deposit of dirt and gravel. Once, very far off, he heard, or thought he heard, the bay of a pack of dogs. But he did not see them, and before the end of the afternoon, he was back home again. When he looked out toward the mountain, he could see no smoke against the sky. He had a certain sense of relief, and yet an even stronger sense of disappointment, now that he had a chance to think it over. That was the way. When the opportunity was at your hand, you did not dare to seize it. When the opportunity was lost, it became precious. The other side of the equation had changed, and he had adjusted by running away. Of course, he might see the smoke again the next morning, but then again, he might not. Perhaps that human being, whoever it was, had merely been passing through that way and could never be found again. He felt a quick rebound of excitement at opportunity regranted when he looked out in the early darkness after supper and suddenly saw a faint but unmistakable light. He hesitated no longer. Now, instead of temporizing, he called Princess, got into the car, and drove in that direction. It was a slow process. His seeing the light must mean merely that the windows of that house happened to face his porch. Probably, he could not have seen it at all before the storm had blown down most of the leaves. As soon as he left the house, he could no longer see the light. He drove back and forth along the streets for half an hour, finally relocated it, drove slowly down the right street, and passed the proper house. The shades had been pulled, but there was light shining through, even illuminating the street a little. It was bright, probably from a gasoline lamp. He brought the car to a stop on the opposite side of the street and waited a moment. Apparently, whoever was inside the house had not heard the motor. For a moment still he hesitated, almost ready now to put the car into gear again and slide off undiscovered. Yet from some deeper drive within him, he leaned forward and half opened the car door as if to get out. Suddenly, Princess leaped by him and ran toward the house with a fury of barking. She must have scented whoever was there. With a sudden curse, he got out and started to walk after her. She had tipped his hand, this time for certain. He hesitated again, suddenly realizing he was unarmed. Yet to advance against the house carrying a gun was not a good opening. Without much thought, he reached back into the car and grabbed his old hammer. Holding it in his hand, he advanced after the dog. In the window of the house, he saw a shadow move. When he had gained the sidewalk, the house door opened a few inches, and suddenly the beam of a flashlight caught him. He could see nothing beyond it. He stopped, waiting for what the other person would have to say. Princess scuttled back, suddenly silent. Ish had the uncomfortable feeling that whoever was keeping him covered with the flashlight had him covered also with a gun, held in the other hand. With the light in his eyes, he was blinded. This had been a crazy thing to do, he thought. An approach under cover of darkness always looked suspicious and made people nervous. At least, he was glad that he had shaved that morning, and that his clothes looked moderately clean. There was a long pause. He stood waiting for the sharply barked question, the inevitable, if slightly ridiculous, "Who are you?" or else for that curt order, "Put up your hands." That was why he had a sudden gasp of surprise when a woman's voice came with an affirmation. "That's a beautiful dog." There was a momentary silence. The memory of the voice in his ears was gentle and low, with a touch of some soft accent in it. At the sound, he felt warm feelings rise up within him. Now the light fell from his eyes, illuminating a path ahead of him, and Princess bounded up through the beam of light, her tail wagging in joy. The door of the house moved open wide, and against the dim light behind her, he saw a woman on her knees patting the dog. He walked up toward her, still with the hammer dangling ridiculously but comfortably from his hand. Then Princess, in a sudden flurry of excitement, burst away and went tearing into the house. The woman leaped up with an exclamation, half screamed, half laughed, and also dashed in. My God, she must have a cat, thought Ish, and rushed after her. But when he arrived in the living room, Princess was merely dashing around the table and smelling at the chairs, and the woman was standing erect beside a gasoline lamp, sheltering it against being overthrown by the excited dog. She was above middle height, brunette, not very young, no mere girl, certainly, but a fully developed woman. She glanced at the antics of the scampering dog and laughed, and the sound of laughter was like something remembered from paradise long ago. She turned to him, and he saw the flash of white teeth in the dark face. Then suddenly, a barrier burst within him, and he laughed joyously. After a moment, she spoke again, neither questioning nor demanding. It's good to see someone. This time, Ish replied, but he could think of nothing better than an apology for the ridiculous hammer which still dangled from his hand. Pardon me for bringing this thing in, he said, and set it down on the floor upon its head with the handle sticking stiffly into the air. Don't worry, she said. I understand. I went through it too, having to have something around to make you feel comfortable. Like a pocket piece or a rabbit foot, you remember? We're still about the same as we used to be, all of us. After the sudden release of the laughter, he was trembling. All his body seemed growing weak. He felt, almost physically, more barriers breaking. Those necessary barriers of defense, built up through the months of loneliness and desperation. He must touch another human being. And he put forward his hand in the old conventional gesture of the handshake. She took it. And doubtless, as she noticed his trembling, she drew him toward a chair and almost pushed him into it. As he sat down, she patted his shoulder lightly. She spoke again, once more, neither questioning nor commanding. I'll get you something to eat. He did not protest, though he had just eaten heartily. But he knew that behind her quiet affirmation lay something more than any call of the body for food. There was need now for the symbolic eating together. That first common bond of human beings, the sitting at the same table, the sharing of the bread and salt. Now they were sitting opposite each other. They ate a little, more in symbol than in reality. There was fresh bread. I made it myself, she said, but it's getting hard to find flour now that's got no weevils in it. There was no butter, but honey and jam for the bread, and a bottle of red wine. And now, like a child, he began to talk. This was nothing like that time when he had sat with Milt and Anne on Riverside Drive. Then the barriers had still been up. Now, for the first time, he talked of all those days. He showed even the little scar of the fangs on his hand, and the larger scars where he had slashed himself to apply the suction pump. He told of his fear and of his flight and of the great loneliness that he had never quite dared face or imagine. And as he talked, she often said, Yes, I know. Yes, I remember that too. Tell me more. As for her, she had seen the catastrophe itself. She had faced more than he had, and yet he could see that she had come through better than he. She talked little, seeming to have no need, but she drew him on. As he talked with her, he knew now at last that this, at least as far as he was concerned, was no mere casual meeting or passing moment. In this lay all the future. Since the disaster, he had seen men and women here and there, and no one before had ever held him. Perhaps time had healed him. More likely, she herself was different. Yet she was a woman. As the minutes slipped by, he sensed that basic reality more and more, with an intensity that made him tremble. As between man and man, the breaking of bread was the reality, the shared table, all the symbol needed. But as between man and woman, there must be still more, in reality and in symbol, a further sharing. They realized suddenly that neither knew the other's name, although each had been calling the dog Princess. Isherwood, he said. That was my mother's maiden name, and so she stuck it on me. Bad, wasn't it? Everybody called me Ish. I'm M, she said. Emma, that is, of course. Ish and M. We won't get very far writing poetry about that combination. And she laughed, and they laughed together. Laughter. That was another sharing. And yet, it was not the final one. There were ways these things were done. He had known men who could do them, had seen them at work, but he, Ish, was not the right kind. All those qualities which had permitted him to be by himself and survive through the bad days alone, all those qualities now came up to work against him. And he sensed, too, very deeply, that they would be wrong. The old methods had worked in the days when there were girls in every cocktail bar looking for adventure, but now such methods were not right, he knew, and knew deeply, at this time, when the vast city stretched away, empty in all directions, outside of the windows, and all the ways of the world had vanished, and this woman had lived through all the catastrophe and the fear and the loneliness, and now had come out on the other side, still with courage in her eyes, and affirmation, and laughter. For a wild moment, he had an idea that they might say some kind of marriage vows. Quakers could marry themselves, why couldn't others? They could stand up together and face toward the east where the morning sun would rise. And then he sensed that the mere babbling of words was in itself much more dishonest even than a straightforward feeling for the knee under the table. He realized that he had been silent for what might have been a full minute. She was looking across at him with level, calm eyes, and he knew that she read his thoughts. In his embarrassment, he rose suddenly to his feet, upsetting the chair as he got up. Then the table between them had ceased to be a symbol joining them together and now held them apart. He stepped from behind it and across toward her as she rose up too. And then there was the softness of her body against his. Oh, Song of Songs, thine eyes, my love, are gentle, and the fullness of thy lips is soft and firm. Thy neck is ivory, and the smoothness of thy shoulders like warm ivory. The softness of thy breasts against me is like fine wool. Thy thighs are firm and strong like the cedars. Oh, Song of Songs. She had gone now into the inner room. He sat, still with breath and heart quick, tense and waiting. He had only one fear now. In a world where there were no doctors and even no other women, how could anyone risk the chance? But she had gone. He realized that she too, in her great affirmation, would consider this also and care for it. Oh, Song of Songs, my love, thy bed is fragrant as boughs of the pine tree, and thy body is warm. Thou art Ashtoreth, thou art Aphrodite, that keepest the gate of love. Now my strength is upon me, now the rivers are pent up. Now is my hour. Oh, receive me in thine infinitude. Chapter 7. He lay quietly awake after she slept beside him, and his thoughts rushed by him so fast that he could not stop them long enough to get to sleep. That was what she had said before, earlier in the evening. No matter what happened to the world, it did not change the person, and he remained what he had been. Yes, that was the way. Though so much had happened, and even though he might be deeply moved by that great experience, yet still he was the observer. The man who sat by the side, watching what happened, never quite losing himself in the experience. The strangeness. In the old world, it might well never have happened. Out of destruction had come for him love. He slept. When he woke, it was daylight and she was gone. He looked around the room fearfully. Yes, it was really a shabby little room, and he suddenly had a fear that perhaps all this seemingly great experience of love was, after all, only something which in the old days would have been no more than a pickup of a restless waitress in a grimy room in a cheap hotel. And she was no goddess. No hamadryad glimpsed whitely in the dusk. Except at the moment of desire, she would never be Ashtoreth or Aphrodite. He trembled a little to think of how she might look in the morning light. She was older than he. Perhaps he was merely mixing her in some vague kind of mother image. Oh, don't worry, he thought, putting it into words. There never has been perfection yet, and it certainly isn't going to start now for me. Then he remembered how she had first spoken, not in question or command, but merely in affirmation. Yes, that was the way it ought to be. Take what was good in a situation, not worrying about what might not be there. He got up and dressed. As he dressed, he sniffed the aroma of coffee. Coffee. That was a kind of modern symbol, too. She had the table set in the breakfast nook when he came out, as any commuter's wife might have done. He looked at her almost bashfully. He saw again, more clearly by morning light, the wide-set black eyes in the dark face, the full ripe lips, the swelling curve of the breasts beneath a light green smock. He did not offer to kiss her, and she did not seem to expect it, but they smiled back and forth, one at the other. "Where's Princess?" he said.
"I put her out for her run."
"Good. And it's going to be a good day, too, I think."
"Yes, looks like it."
"Sorry there are no eggs."
"No matter."
"What is it?" "Bacon, I see."
"Yes."
They were little words, meaning nothing, yet there was a great joy to say them. A greater joy, perhaps, saying the little things than saying something much greater. A whole contentment came over him. This was no affair of the rented room. His luck was in. He looked across into her level eyes and felt new security and courage rise up within him. This would endure. They moved back later that day to the house on San Lupo Drive, chiefly because he seemed to have more possessions, books especially, than she did. It was less trouble to move to the books than to move the books to them. The days went more swiftly and more comfortably after that. There were many ways of sharing. What was it, he thought? A friend doubles joys and cuts griefs in half? She never talked about herself. Once or twice he tried to draw her out with questions, thinking that she might need to tell things. But she did not respond easily, and he decided that she had already made her adjustment in her own way. She had drawn the veil across the view toward the past. Now she looked forward only. Yet she made no apparent attempt at secrecy. He learned from casual remarks that she had been married, happily, he was sure, and had had two small children. She had gone to high school, but not to college. Her grammar lapsed occasionally. Her soft accent, which he had noticed when she first spoke, had perhaps the touch of Kentucky or Tennessee in it, but she never mentioned having lived anywhere except in California. Her social status must have been, Ish judged, somewhat lower than his. But there was nothing more ridiculous to contemplate now than all that business of social classes. Amazing how little everything like that matters now. And the days slid by easily. One morning, finding that they needed some supplies, he went down to start the car. He put his thumb on the starter button. There was a sudden click, nothing more. He pressed it again, and it clicked. That was all. He heard no sudden comforting whir as the motor took over, no reassuring little bangs as the cold cylinders began to fire. Panic fell upon him again. He pressed the button once more, and still once more, and every time came only the little click. Battery gone, he thought. He got out, raised the hood of the car, and stared hopelessly at the orderly but complex array of wires and gadgets. It was too much for him. He had a sudden hopeless feeling within him. He went back to the house. The car won't start, he said. Battery gone or something. He knew that his face must be even more woebegone than his voice. That was why he could hardly believe it when she laughed. There's no place we have to go so badly as all that, she said. To look at you, you'd think that things had gone to pieces. Then he laughed too. It made all the difference in the world whether you had that other to cut the grief in half, and the trouble suddenly seemed tiny. The car was convenient when you wanted to go to the stores and load up with some more supplies, but you could live just as well without a car. She was right. They had really no place that they needed so badly to go. He had imagined a desperate day, trying to find a new car to fix up the old one. As it was, they made it a sport, even though it did take them most of the morning before they located another one. Most of the cars had no keys in them, and while he might have shorted a wire somewhere, they agreed that it would be an inconvenience to have to drive a car without a key. And when they found one with a key in it, the battery, unused now for several months, would not work. At last they found one that had a key in it and was parked on a hill. The battery was too weak to turn the engine over, but it would burn the lights faintly, and Ish judged that it would send out enough of a current to fire the spark plugs. They got the car rolling downhill, and then, after a minute, the cylinders began to bang and putter and backfire. Ish and M laughed together happily at the adventure of it. At last, the gasoline worked up through the feed pipes, and the engine warmed and began to run smoothly. Now they laughed in triumph and went speeding at 60 miles an hour down the empty boulevard, and M leaned over and kissed him. And suddenly, queer as it seemed, Ish realized that he had never felt so happy in his life. This car was not such a good one as the station wagon. Because of this, they used it merely to make some exploration through the warehouse district, checking up in the classified telephone book to locate dealers and batteries. At last, they forced the entrance to the proper room and found dozens of batteries with the acid not yet in them. There were also supplies of acid. And although neither of them was mechanically minded, they made the experiment of pouring the acid into a battery of the right size. They took it back and put it into the station wagon. It worked perfectly the first time. As at last the motor of the station wagon hummed tunefully, responding to the pressure of his foot on the throttle, Ish thought that on that day he had met and faced two problems. First, he had seen that he could do a great deal toward keeping a car running for a long time. But of even greater importance, he had faced the possibility that there would come a time when there would no longer be any cars, and yet still he could live happily and without fear. The next day, indeed, the new battery in the station wagon was dead again. Either it was defective, or he had made some mistake in installing it. This time, however, he was in no panic. In fact, he did not even bother to do anything about it for a couple of days. Then they repeated the process. Either by luck or by greater care, they had better success, and the battery continued to work. Sleek with lacquer, shining with chromium, their motors machined to the thousandth of the inch, their commutators accurate as watches, they had been the pride and the symbol of civilization. Now, they were locked ingloriously in garages, or stood in the lots, or were parked at the curb. The dead leaves dropped, the blowing dust settled. The rains fell and spotted the dust and made the leaves stick more tightly, and then more dust and more leaves fell. The windshields were so thickly coated that you could scarcely see through them now. More deeply, they changed little. The rust ate here and there, but on the grease-smeared surfaces, it could not work rapidly. Unused, the coils and the timers, the carburetors and the spark plugs all remained as good as ever. In the batteries, the slow processes of chemistry worked day and night, breaking down, neutralizing. A few months and the unused batteries were dead. But as long as the battery and acid were kept separate, neither deteriorated, and it would always be a small matter to add the acid and start out again with a new battery. The batteries were not the weakest link. More likely, it was the tires. In the rubber, the processes of decay worked slowly. The tires would last a year, 5 years, but nevertheless, the weakness worked in them. The air leaked from the tires, and after the car had stood on the flat tires for a while, they were no longer of any use. Even in the warehouses, decay worked in the rubber. The stored tires would have 10 years, and still some life. 20 years they would last, perhaps even more. Quite likely the roads themselves would be broken, and men forget how to drive cars and lose the desire for driving them before the cars themselves were rendered undrivable. Her head rested in the crook of his arm, and he looked down upon the black liquid eyes. They lay on the davenport in the living room. Her face looked darker than ever now in the twilight. There was one question he knew that they had not yet faced, and now she brought it forward.
"That would be fine," she said.
"I don't know."
"Yes, it would."
"I don't like it."
"You mean you don't like it about me?"
"Yes. It's dangerous. There'd be no one else but me, and I wouldn't be any use."
"But you can read all the books."
"Books?" He laughed a little as he spoke. "The Practical Midwife? The Pathology of Parturition? I don't think I'd like to face it, even if you would."
"But yet, you really could find some books and read them. That would be a lot of use, and I wouldn't really need so much help."
She paused a moment.
"I've been through it twice before, you know. It wasn't bad."
"Maybe not, but it might be different this time without hospitals and doctors and all that."
"And just why do you think so much about it?" "Biology, don't they call it, or something like that? I guess it's natural."
"Do you think life must go on? We have a duty to the future, all that?" She paused a minute. He could tell that she was thinking, and thinking was not the best thing that she did. She reacted at deeper levels than those of mere thought.
"Oh, I don't know," she said. "I don't know whether life needs to go on. Why should it? Just as likely I'm selfish. I want a baby for myself. I mean, oh, I don't talk this sort of thing well. I'd like to be kissed, though."
He did it.
"I wish I could talk," she said. "I wish I could tell what it is I think about it."
Then she stretched her arm out and took a match from the box on the table. She smoked more than he did, and he expected her to take a cigarette also, but she did not.
It was a big kitchen match, the kind she liked. She turned it between thumb and finger, saying nothing. Then she scratched it against the box. The match had spurted into a flare. Then the fierceness faded out, and the wood of the match shank burned quietly in yellow flame. Suddenly she blew it out. Vaguely he knew that she, who did not find words easily, had tried, perhaps half unconsciously, to act out something that she could not say. Slowly he thought that he understood. The match lived, not when it lay in the box, but merely when it burned, and it could not burn forever. So too with men and women. Not by denying life was life lived. He thought then of his old fear during the first days, and of the time when he had overthrown it, when he had unlashed the motorcycle from the tailgate of the station wagon in the desert and tossed it to one side. He remembered the wild feeling of exaltation which had come when he had offered defiance to death and all the powers of darkness. He felt her body stir gently in his arms. Yes, he thought humbly. That strong courage was his only at great moments. With her, it was part of daily life. All right, he said. I suppose you're right. I'll read the books. You know, she said, I might need a little more help than that. Her body was close and warm against him. Still he held back, feeling all the loneliness and the emptiness and the terror. Who was he to set mankind again on the long and uncertain road to the future? But it was only for a moment. Then her courage and the confidence of her courage flowed out from her to him. Yes, he thought, she will be the mother of nations. Without courage, there is nothing. And then suddenly he was conscious again of her body, and his strength came upon him. To thee be the glory, because the love of life was brighter before thy face than the fear of death was dark. Thou art Demeter and Hertha and Isis, Cybele of the lions and the mountain mother. From thy daughters shall spring tribes, and from thy grandsons nations. Thy name is the Mother, and they shall call thee blessed. There will be laughter and song again. Maidens will walk in the meadows, young men leap by the brooks. Their children's children shall be again as the pine trees of the mountainside. They shall call thee blessed, because in a dark time, thy look was toward the light. While they were still uncertain, M looked out one morning and said, See? Some rats. He looked. Sure enough, two rats were nosing their way along the base of the hedge, foraging about or merely investigating. M pointed out the rats to Princess through the window and then opened the door. But being a dog who gave tongue to tell the hunter where the chase was leading, she leaped out baying, and the rats vanished before she was anywhere near them. That afternoon they saw more rats at several times, one place and another, near the house, in the street, or running in the gardens. Next morning, the wave had engulfed them. Rats were everywhere. These were merely ordinary-looking rats, no larger or smaller than rats were expected to be. Not particularly fat or particularly lean, just rats. Ish thought of the way the ants had been some time ago and felt a cold shiver run through him. The only thing to do was to make an investigation and thus render the rats less horrible, because when you knew something about the situation, you saw the interest that lay in it. In the station wagon, they drove about here and there, often crushing some rat which decided to dash across the street just ahead of their tires. At first, they shuddered a little at the soft squash and looked at each other. But before long, it had become so common that they thought nothing about it. The area which the rats were occupying was roughly the city, although they spread outward from the built-up area, covering somewhat larger an area than the ants had done. What had happened in general was clear enough. Ish remembered some kind of statistics which declared that the number of rats in a city was generally about equal to the number of people. Well, he explained to M, you start then with, say, 1 million rats, half of them being does or bitches or whatever you call lady rats. Some of the stores and warehouses are rat-proof, but still there has been for all this time what you can call an unlimited supply of food. Then how many rats should there be now? I can't do that problem in my head. I'll try later. That evening at home, he sat down to it as a mathematical problem. With the aid of his father's encyclopedia, he determined that rats had approximately 1 litter a month, with an average of about 10 young. That is, 1 month of uninterrupted breeding might have produced about a population of 10 million rats in this given area. These young females, in turn, would begin to breed before they reached the age of 2 months. There must be some casualties, of course, and he had no way of determining just how many of the rats would live to maturity. But certainly the increase must be prodigious under the circumstances. His mathematics broke down. But even if the rats should only be increasing at the rate of doubling their numbers every month, an estimate which seemed ridiculously conservative, there should by this time be already somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 million. If they were increasing threefold each month, an estimate which still seemed conservative, there would now be in the area approximately 1 billion rats. As he considered the problem, he saw no reason at all why the rats, with unlimited food, might not possibly quadruple their numbers every month. In the old times, man had been the only important natural enemy of the city rats, and even man had had to maintain constant war against them to keep their numbers under control. With man gone, their only enemies would have been the small number of dogs, whose instinct led them to catch rats and somewhat larger number of cats. But here, a secondary result must have influenced the situation in favor of the rats. As he had noticed, the rat-catching dogs seemed to hold the ground alone without the help of any cats. Probably the dogs had killed the cats as much as they had the rats, and so had eliminated the chief control. And in the end, the dogs themselves had probably been overwhelmed in the mere increase of numbers. Now he no longer saw any dogs. It seemed unlikely that they had actually been killed by the rats, although the rats may very well have cleaned out many litters of puppies. Probably the dogs had merely retreated before the swarms of rats and were still hanging around on the outskirts, now having been driven from the city into the suburbs. Whether there were 1 billion rats or only 50 million made very little difference. There certainly were too many rats, and Ish and M felt themselves in a state of siege. They watched all the doors carefully. Nevertheless, one rat appeared in the kitchen from some unknown quarter, and they had a mad scurry as Ish pursued it with a broom. Cornered, it leaped viciously at the broom handle and left teeth marks in the hard wood before he was able to crush it against the floor. After a few days, moreover, they began to see a kind of difference, both in the appearance and in the behavior of the rats. Apparently the supplies of food, vast though they were, had at last begun to yield before the attack of an ever-pyramiding number of rats. The rats now appeared thinner, and they ran around even more feverishly in search of food.